This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Later this hour, we'll look at how fiction writers are addressing climate change. Call it climate fiction or cli-fi. But first, with the primaries underway, springtime has become the season of canvassing. You might have received one of those knocks at the door, a volunteer asking for just a minute of your time. Do these short face-to-face chats really work, though? Can you change a voter's mind? A study out in Science this week looked at the effects of canvassing on changing attitudes towards transgender people. Azine Gureshi is here to tell us about this study and some other science news from the week. She's a science writer at BuzzFeed. She joins us here in our studios. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we've seen a study kind of like this before that was retracted. How is this different?
Yeah. So the backstory to this is there was a huge study that came out in 2014 showing that if gay canvassers went door to door, that they could effectively change voters' minds about gay marriage. This was a huge study. It was published in Science. There was a This American Life episode on it. It was sort of touted as a huge development because it had never been shown before, really, that you could actually change people's minds. It was thought to be pretty stubbornly held, those types of beliefs. Then these two grad students, Josh Kalla and David Brockman, were brought in to do a follow-up study looking at trans attitudes and whether that same sort of shift could happen. What they found when they started looking into the LaCour study, the original one, was that basically, he hadn't actually done the analysis at all. The entire analysis had been faked. It was this huge controversy. The paper had to be retracted from Science, and the field was sort of temporarily cast, and there was sort of a shadow cast over it that you know, this wasn't actually true. What's interesting, though, is that the two grad students actually ended up completing their study looking at trans attitudes, and the paper that was just published this week showed that, in fact, a 10-minute conversation with either a trans canvasser or anyone else could effectively change voter attitudes.
Or with a trans canvasser or anyone else. That's different. That's interesting.
So that was different from the original study. And what they actually, so they had 56 canvassers going to about 500 people. The control group, they talked about recycling. But the 250 people who got the talk about trans attitudes actually showed a durable and huge sort of change in positive attitudes towards trans people.
Does it matter how good the canvassers are? I mean, how the quality of the conversation you're having or anything?
They did have a sort of, the actual conversations are quite elaborately, deliberately meant to sort of put the person in a trans person's shoes, sort of think about anyone in their lives they've known who've been, like, excluded. There is sort of definitely an art to it.
Of course, the issue is transgender attitudes is pretty timely right now, isn't it?
Yes. So this is now being heralded as a huge victory because across cities and states in the U.S., Houston, Mississippi, Tennessee, and most recently North Carolina, there have been many anti-LGBT ordinances passed. A lot of the ones specifically focusing on trans people have been the bathroom laws that have been trying to restrict which bathrooms trans individuals can use.
So these findings are coming out at a really interesting time. There's another report in BuzzFeed this week that looked at government aerial surveillance programs. First of all, really, really cool pictures in this. But what are the patterns in this report find?
Right. So this was a huge investigative endeavor by Peter Althaus and Charles Seif. They looked at flight pattern data from mid-August of last year to the end of December. And then they found 200 planes that were part of a federal airborne surveillance program. So basically what they saw was that every weekday, planes piloted by either FBI agents or the Department of Homeland Security fly and slowly circle over major American cities. These planes are outfitted with high-resolution video cameras. They often have augmented reality software that can superimpose street names, business names, people's names, anything. Some have devices that can track cell phones, exhaust mufflers. They're floating about a mile above the ground. And what they found that was particularly interesting was that the flights actually drop off by about 70% every weekend and federal holiday.
So hold it. They're flying during the week, the surveillance, but they're sort of taking the weekends off?
Yeah. So this is, it's weird, right? Basically, privacy advocates have argued that this is indication that these aren't sort of high-profile, dangerous terrorist targets, for example. These are routine surveillance that are being conducted, sort of 9-to-5 weekday activities. And this is something that the FBI has denied before. They can't launch investigations based on race, ethnicity, or religion, i.e. groups of people versus individual suspects. But it seems like that's what's going on here.
Yeah, if you really want to take a look at these maps, you sort of can see the various places and wonder why there are planes with the FBI flying over some spots. I want to turn to another study that looks at the obesity epidemic globally. We've been hearing a lot of obesity news over the years that's not good. This is not good news, is it?
This seems particularly bad. So they basically, these researchers out of London looked at data from 1975 to 2014 in adults 18 and over, 186 countries, over 19.2 million people. And they looked at the body mass index of those people over time. And they found that for the first time ever, we now have more obese people than underweight people in the world. The number of obese people has jumped from 105 million in 1975 to 641 million in 2014. That's a six-fold increase in 40 years. And for men, it's gone up from 3.2% to 10.8% of men are obese, women 6.4% to 14.9%.
And are there some places where there's more of a problem than others? I would assume there is.
There is definitely. I mean, in the six high-income English-speaking countries alone, there were 118 million obese people. And yeah, what was really interesting and also particularly problematic is that although there are now more obese people than underweight people, the number of underweight people has also increased. So we've seen an increase from 330 million in 1975 to 462 million in 2014. And the researchers say that the problem really is the same then. We're really seeing that people either are not having enough to eat or they're not having enough good things to eat.
Okay, so I've got 1 minute to ask you about a transplant between a pig and a baboon?
Yes. So a baboon has survived for over 2 years, 945 days, with a pig heart in its body in addition to its own. This is part of xenotransplantation, which is basically trying to look for interspecies transplants because we have obviously a shortage of human organs. 8,000 people die a year waiting for transplants. Pigs are about the right size for potential organ transplants for us, so they're testing it out in baboons first. And this is almost double the amount that it survived in a baboon's body before. These are genetically modified pig organs that are made to survive in a baboon's body without them rejecting it. So this is a huge deal. And so the next phase is going to be them trying to actually replace the baboon's heart with the pig's heart and see if
it can
also
survive. So not just a heart inside the baboon, but actually a working heart inside
a
baboon. So this is the next thing. My goodness. Azim Gureshi is science writer at BuzzFeed. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side, there are several efforts to try to bring limited internet access to people in the developing world by zero rating certain services and sites, not charging for data to and from those services on a mobile phone. Now, Facebook's effort was eventually banned in India after regulators decided you couldn't give a financial preference to some sites over others, a kind of a net neutrality argument. Now there's another snag. People are finding a way to use the free services in ways that the creators probably did not intend. Joining me now to talk about it is Jason Kebler. He's a staff writer at Motherboard. You can read his articles on Wikipedia Zero in Angola there. Welcome back to the program, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So sketch out what's happening here.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy story. So there are two services, Facebook Free Basics and Wikipedia Zero, which allow people in Angola and other developing countries to use data for free. The average cost of data in these countries is very high. The salary is very low. So this is often their only access to the internet. And basically what they're doing in Angola is uploading movies, music, pirated data in general to Wikipedia, and then they're sharing it using Facebook.
So hold it. They're like burying it in Wikipedia entries?
Yeah, they're burying it deep in Wikimedia Commons, which is kind of this free repository of Creative Commons type stuff. And they're kind of hiding it as PDF or JPEG files and then putting them on Facebook and saying, hey, here's a new Star Wars movie. It's like being hidden as a book.
And it's being hidden so there's a Facebook site, and it's a closed group, right, that you can't just join, and they're telling people where to search on Wikimedia for this free stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty ingenious, and it kind of just underscores the fact that these people want access to the broader internet. This is, like, Wikipedia and Facebook are great services, but in the developed world, we can pirate things if we choose to. It might not be legal, but we have the opportunity to do it. And they're kind of making the best of a bad situation.
I'm going to guess that the copyright holders of the movies and other content think that this is all a very bad thing. But what's the good thing here? I mean, you said it's creative, certainly.
Right. It's definitely creative. The good thing is that they're getting some sort of access. I want to kind of talk about the bad thing, though, is that it's not the copyright holders who are stopping them from doing this. It's the Wikipedia editors in Portugal, because Angola is a former Portuguese colony. And they have kind of like a very – Wikipedia editors in general have a very strict rule set. And they're saying, you know, they're kind of ruining our site. And it's interesting because you're saying you guys can have this product, but you have to use it exactly how we say. And so it's sort of this form of like digital colonialism is kind of what it's being called. And it's hard to say who is right here because, you know, these people want to be able to share files, which is very important. And the people in Portugal want to be able to have their site not be defaced, I guess. And there's kind of no real good answer here other than opening up cheaper, you know, access to the full internet.
Is it a bandwidth problem for them? I mean, are they seeing their Wikimedia source being cluttered with all sorts of stuff that now they have to find bandwidth for?
Right. They're calling it defacement. I mean, I think that if you've ever gone into like the talk pages of a Wikipedia article, people fight over everything. And basically, it's just they're using the product in a way that is illegal, maybe not in Angola because they have different copyright laws. It actually might be legal there, but it's illegal in most of the world to share copyrighted material for free. And they just kind of don't want this sort of thing on their site.
We just have a moment, but there is this sort of interesting notion, though, that you give people something for free and then you tell them how they have to use it. I mean, I think probably the people in Angola are saying, well, look, I have access to something that I didn't have access to before, and I want to watch cat videos and movies, too, just like the West does.
Right. They want to do everything that we're doing. And there's this saying about copyright and piracy in general is that life finds a way, kind of like that Jurassic Park quote. Piracy finds a way often.
It's usually one of the first things that people try to do on the internet, among other things. Jason Kebler is a staff writer at Motherboard. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk about the impact of climate change on cultures, both in the past and also in the future. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankowski. You've heard about the impacts of climate change. Ice sheets are melting at record rates. Coastal towns are at risk of being wiped out by rising tides. But can climate change disrupt culture? Researchers say they found a link between climate change and the rise and fall of the Pueblo and ancient civilizations of the Southwest. Their results were published in the journal Science Advances. Kyle Bosinski is one of the authors on that paper. He's also the director of sponsored projects at the Crow Canyon Archaeological Center in Cortez, Colorado. Kyle, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
If you want to join us, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So you're looking at Native Americans in the Southwest over 1,000 years ago. Can you describe for us what the area was like then?
Yeah. It was occupied by the ancestral Pueblo people whose descendants are still with us today. And they were agricultural people. They were corn farmers and living and trying to make a living in the Four Corners region. So that's Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and in Utah. And life was sort of like it was today. You know, they had this mode of economy that was based around corn, and they were trying to make a living and living in towns. But those towns fell apart at different times.
So you looked at tree ring data to find out what was happening with the climate in some of the years that people were productive and building. Tell us about the links there.
Yeah, so we brought together two large databases based on tree rings. One is tree ring dates from archaeological sites. So when people built with wood, tree ring scientists, dendrochronologists, can go and actually date those pieces of wood by looking at the ring widths from that wood. And so we took a large database of 30,000 or so of these tree ring dates and then compared it to a reconstruction also based on tree rings of where and when they could grow corn in the past.
Mm. So what did this tell us? What did the corn growing patterns tell you?
Well, it told us a couple of interesting things. First of all, it told us that that droughts didn't always impact societies in the past. There were plenty of times in which the Pueblo people did just fine in the face of pretty dramatic climate downturns. But we also found that a combination of social organization, inequality, and climate change did prompt revolutions in Pueblo society. And not just once, but four times in the Pueblo past between AD 500 and 1400.
When you're talking about revolutions, like what kind of revolutions?
Well, they were sort of the upending of the way that people were living. You know, at different times, people started moving into towns, and they were building these large villages and going out and farming what could have been communal farms. But these places were pretty unequal at different times. So, for instance, around the early 1100s, people were building these large structures that we call chaco and great houses. And they would have taken a lot of people coming together and building these large buildings all across the Southwest. Well, during the mid-1100s, that entire system falls apart. There's a lot of violence on the landscape. People leave those great houses, leave those villages, and start living sort of on their own out in hamlets or small farming towns across the Southwest. But over time, they aggregated together again and formed large villages once again, and the cycle sort of repeated itself. A climate challenge came along, a big drought, and that undermined the sort of credibility of that social system, and people said, you know what, we're done with it, we're going to try something different.
So talk a bit more about how we know that climate was actually what was causing the problems in the societies, how it wasn't just some human factor that we couldn't possibly know about.
Well, and that's the thing. We think it was human factors that really did cause these issues. But it just so happens that their basic economic product, their means of production, corn, when that fell apart, that undermined the credibility of those social systems. And we know this a couple of different ways. We actually can see in the archaeological record these big shifts in behavior. We see shifts at times from people being very uniform in how they're behaving and how they're building their homes and how they're making their ceramics and how they're farming. And then that breaks down and they go out on the landscape and try completely new things. We know at one point the Pueblo people did most of their food storage in external sort of cists outside their home. And that transitions to people storing their corn inside their homes in above-ground pueblos, and we take that as a change in attitude towards food sharing. And finally, the biggest transition that we see, and the most famous one, happens in the late 1200s when people completely left the Four Corners region. The Pueblo people completely left the Four Corners region in the Southwest and moved to Point South. And at that time, they actually created an entirely new society, and we see it in their architecture. They went from living in these villages where people were in very different size homes and had differential access to resources like fancy pottery or deer meat, which was a prized form of food at the time, to living in these large plaza pueblos. And what I mean is they're like large apartment buildings where everybody was in these cookie cutter sized apartments all around a central plaza where all the ritual took place in these villages. Mm. So everybody had equal access to these resources. So they move from a society where there's a lot of inequality to one where you have a more egalitarian, more communitarian system.
So I'm sure a lot of people in places like California that have been experiencing long droughts are kind of wondering, are the droughts that you were looking at back then similar to the ones that we're having right now?
I think they are. They're similar both in duration, but they're even more similar in that they're happening in a social context of great inequality in our country. And in fact, I see it not only in climate change that we see, but if you connect climate with the economy, and for the Pueblo people, they were intimately connected. We really see a lot of similarities with small but not insignificant economic impacts that can happen, like in 2008 with the recession.
All right. So without getting too political, I suppose, in the last minute, I have to ask you, what should we learn from this? What can we take from what you've learned about these ancient civilizations and apply it to how we might adapt to climate change today?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing is that inequality, especially within economic and ritual systems and government systems, can have a real pernicious effect and destabilize societies from the bottom up. So people have, when you live in an unequal system that's hierarchical, people can blame that system. And I think that the current dialogue that's happening in this country has to do with that type of process.
Kyle Baczynski.
And we saw it.
Yeah. Well, we saw it back then. Maybe we're seeing it again today. It's on
That's a lot
of TV news channels instead. But Kyle Baczynski is the director of sponsored projects at the Crow Canyon Archaeological Center in Cortez, Colorado. It's fascinating stuff. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Tree rings and archaeological data can tell the story of how climate change shaped the Southwest 1,000 years ago. But this week, I read a novel that was all about the future of that region. The Water Knife imagines the Southwest 50, maybe 75 years from now. And the picture it paints of our climate change future is not pretty. In the world of The Water Knife, Arizona, Nevada, and California are locked in an all-out war over water. Las Vegas is out to secure its water supply by any means necessary, using shady legal tactics and outright violence to suck its neighbors dry. Meanwhile, in Phoenix, the price of water has hit $6.95 a liter. In Texas, an entire population of climate refugees is on the move. The man behind this dystopia is sci-fi writer Paolo Bacigalupi, and he's not the only storyteller who's been speculating about our climate change future. The last few years have seen a minor boom in novels about climate change. You can call it climate fiction or cli-fi. It's what we'll be talking about for the rest of this hour, and we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite piece of fiction or novel or film about climate change? Tell us about it. 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us some of your ideas at SciFry. Let me bring in our guests. Paolo Bacigalupi is the author of The Water Knife and other novels, including The Wind-Up Girl. He joins us today from Paonia, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Lemonager is the Moore Professor of English and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon, where she's taught climate fiction in her classroom. She joins us today from Eugene. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie, I'll start with you. How old is this idea of climate fiction? When did you start to see writers bringing climate change into their stories?
You know, I think climate change came very early into the world of fiction. Going all the way back to the 1890s or so with works by Jules Verne. But climate change as we know it now and responsive to climate science as we understand it in relation to global climate change really doesn't become a well-known topic of fiction and other kinds of speculative writing until the early 20th century. It may be that there's one outlier novel called Heat by Arthur Herzog, which was published in 1977, but I would place climate fiction's genealogy and its sort of origin point more or less in the early 21st century with the work of Margaret Atwood, her fabulous Mad Adam trilogy starting in 2003, the work of Kim Stanley Robinson, 40 Signs of Rain was 2004, of course, Paolo's terrific books, Wind-Up Girl, 2009, I believe, and the Pump 6 collection of 2008. The work of Ian McEwan, Solar, 2010, Flight Behavior, 2012, Barbara Kingsolver. So I see this as a sort of the first decade of the 21st century phenomenon that grows up in response to, in a way, the dissemination and popularization of climate science in the larger culture, people getting more familiar with that, whether they wish to believe it or deny it. Nonetheless, it becomes a strong topic of conversation. And then stories seem to come about in response to that scientific knowledge.
You mentioned the Barbara Kingsolver novel, Flight Behavior. It's one
yes.
of the things that you teach in your class. Tell us a bit about it.
You know, I think it's a terrific novel. It reminds me a lot of the reformist fiction of the 19th century. I think about fiction by people like Charles Dickens and even Harriet Beecher Stowe. And I mention those 19th century novels because they were novels that were meant to profoundly critique and change the socioeconomic structure of, in one case, Britain, the other case, the United States. And what Kingsolver does is she looks really broadly at the different kinds of stakeholders that might be involved in a climate change future, not just people who are already on the bandwagon, not just environmentalists, but rural people, in Appalachia, in West Virginia, people looking at mountaintop removal from a variety of different standpoints, people of faith in faith-based communities that may or may not connect to climate science and feel comfortable with it. And she tries to create a kind of coalitional public around climate change through the novel, with science at the very beating heart and the center of that. And I really appreciated that effort of not just looking at a community of experts, not denigrating working class people, people of faith who might not be at the center of these conversations, but trying to invite them and give them access to what is, in my mind, the most profound socio-ecological problem that we've ever faced as a species.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about climate fiction on the program. Paolo Bacigalupi, I know you committed to actually writing The Water Knife after a trip you made to Texas. What did you see on the trip that made you think, I have to write this story?
Well, I was down in Texas in 2011, and they were in the middle of a terrible drought at that time. They were experiencing record numbers of 100-degree days. They were having to put cattle down on the land because the land couldn't support them. They were having crop failures. They were also having electrical failures, brownouts, because their reservoirs were low, and so they didn't have enough hydraulic head to turn their turbines. And so at the same time that people were needing more electricity than ever to run their air conditioners against the heat, they were experiencing electricity shortages. And all of that was really interesting, but the thing that was most interesting to me about all of that terrible stuff was that it broadly matches exactly what climate scientists say the future of Texas should look like as an average, kind of. And so in that moment when you're standing there in a drought, you realize that you're actually not in a drought anymore. You're time traveling. You've had a chance to step into the future and see that moment, future Texas, what is it? And you look around and you say, so what is this? And you say, it's scary. It feels very scary. But then on top of that, at the same time that all of that was happening, Rick Perry, the governor of Texas and a presidential candidate at the time, was going around and urging people to pray for rain. And that, coupled with this terrible sort of oncoming disaster scenario, really sort of got me going, was this feeling like, oh, here's the future coming at us. The data tells us it's dangerous and it's going to be bad, and our leadership is engaged in magical thinking. That was the moment that I sort of thought that, okay, I need to write The Water Knife.
Well, and your story is really about two cities, one that plans for climate change and one that doesn't. Give us a little picture of these two cities, Las Vegas and Phoenix.
Right. Well, the interesting thing to me about all of this is that I do believe that we as human beings have a great capacity to adapt, to succeed, but it all depends on us being reality-based creatures. We have to engage with reality in order to succeed. And sort of Rick Perry kind of crystallized that for me. So when I was setting up the story for The Water Knife, Las Vegas was intended very much to represent a city that looks around and says, we're in a terrible position. We live in the middle of a desert. We have very scarce water resources. The water resources that we have are tenuous. And so what are we going to do to make sure that we come out as winners at the other end of this? And so, you know, they make certain kinds of deals with the other states so that they can keep their water flowing. They create a cadre of people called water knives, which is the title for the book. And these are sort of the 007s of water. They do go out and blow up other people's water treatment plants. They give other people offers on their water rights that they can't refuse. Las Vegas has decided that they're going to do everything that they can to survive. And while they're doing all of that, they've also built these massive arcologies, these sort of integrated cities that allow them to recycle all of their water and all of their waste and sort of keep all of their resources within them so that they are never wasting anything.
And one little detail on there that brings this to life for me is the clear sack. Can you just quickly describe your clear sacks?
Yeah, sure. So for the wealthy, they get to live in arcologies, but the poor, there's also an economic solution to being starved for water, and that's the clear sacks. And clear sacks are essentially these plastic bags that people can pee into and then squeeze the bag, and what filters out is clean water. And so, you know, for the poor, you can drink your own urine, basically, is the solution.
I must say that's one of the many parts of your book that leads to a fairly bleak future. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got more stories about climate change, from some cautiously optimistic to the apocalyptic. You can share some of your ideas about climate fiction at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, sitting in for Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about climate fiction, cli-fi. Do we need compelling stories if we're going to reckon with climate change? My guests are Paolo Bacigalupi. He's a science fiction writer and the author of the novel The Water Knife, just out in paperback. He joins us today from Paonia, Colorado. Stephanie Lemonager is Moore Professor of English and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon in Eugene. We'd like to hear from you. If you've got a favorite novel, film, or work of fiction that touches on climate change, tell us about it. 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can tweet us at SciFry. We're going to get to some of your ideas in just a moment. Stephanie, you teach a book called Odds Against Tomorrow. Tell us about that one.
This is a really interesting book by Nathaniel Rich, which kind of came in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, and then Sandy was, in some ways, I think, retroactively built into the novel. And I'd call it almost a hipster take on risk society, by which I mean the modern world we live in, which kind of incorporates an assumption of potential catastrophic risk. So we start with that as a norm, in a way of living with risk. And then we move into, after this catastrophic event, this flood of Manhattan, we move into an interesting kind of neo-frontierist narrative in which the protagonist begins to relive a life in the wetlands on the edge of New York with all kinds of DIY small technologies, repurposing the infrastructure of the place he's now inhabiting, and moving into what we might think of as hipster ecological adaptations like backyard gardening. So there's a way in which this is, I think, both a very contemporary take on what maybe individuals can do to adapt to or combat climate change, climate shift. But it's also, at least at the sort of early stages of the novel, a profound critique of a culture in which we simply accept catastrophic risk as part of what we assume to be the modern and the wealth of our own consumer culture.
Well, Stephanie, what do you think is challenging about writing these stories? I mean, something like climate change unfolds over a long period of time. While certainly there are storms being caused by climate change, an awful lot of the story is this slow developing thing that doesn't necessarily have the normal type of dramatic arc of a novel. What are some of the challenges you see?
Well, I think that climate change is a real challenge for novelists and for other kinds of writers because it is unfolding over multiple time schemes, multiple scales, and in many different parts of the world. No question that's a complex problem and a hyper object, to use my colleague Timothy Morton's phrase. But what's really good about climate fiction, or fiction that at least deals with the climate in some fashion, is that it makes very material and local conditions that might otherwise seem abstract, distant in time or place. I mean, fiction gives us a world in which to manipulate possible realities, potential outcomes, new social configurations, and ways of not just adapting but fighting the kinds of climate politic deadlocks that we've seen, both in our country and in others. So we have a very concrete and small world often in fiction in which to really think through how we might develop a point of view and an agency, a kind of agency within a system, the climate system, that has gone askew and that's very, very difficult for most people to grasp in its entirety. Mm.
So, Paolo, how do you deal with some of these challenges of telling a story about climate change in The Water Knife?
Well, I think that the first thing that you have to do is you have to look at climate change in a specific location. I think that it is a big topic, and so you have to sort of burrow down into a spot. And so for me, I took the Colorado River and the western United States because it already is a sort of a climate-vulnerable region. But then you can sort of start parsing the already existing politics and the already existing social situations and start extrapolating outwards to say, if this goes on, what will the world look like? If the Colorado River keeps getting lower, what will the world look like? And that's sort of the mechanism that science fiction always works inside of, is that extrapolative sort of taking a look at a trend and then sort of turning up the volume on it. Ultimately, what you're trying to do, I think, is the thing that all fiction that's really interesting and good does is it builds empathy for something. You know, fiction has this opportunity to help us have empathy for people who we've never known, live inside of the skin of different genders, of different social experiences, all sorts of different things. With science fiction, the opportunity is you can sort of extend that empathy not just to around the world, but into the future and to sort of weight a future person's experience. And so if I can tell a story of a climate refugee, a girl who's fled out of Texas and has gotten as far as Phoenix and now is trapped in Phoenix because state border control laws prevent her from going anywhere else and living there in as a second-class citizen in a city that's also falling apart because it has its own water problems. If I can introduce her and create enough of an engaging story around here, suddenly we're going to have a different idea about what climate change means because we've lived inside of it. And I think that's the key thing that fiction brings to the table, and it's the superpower that fiction has, is that suddenly the thing that was abstract, that was a bunch of data, that was, you know, scientific reports, suddenly is a real, intense, visceral experience. And ideally that means that the next time a reader opens up the New York Times and sees a photograph of Low Lake Mead with the water levels low and the blue sky and the white bathtub ring around the Low Lake Mead, they suddenly see that as a horror object as opposed to a sort of a passive photo of the landscape.
I want to get to some ideas that our callers have. Let's go first to Dave, who's calling from Akron, Ohio. Hi there, Dave. You're on Science Friday.
Hey, Jonathan. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah,
I just wanted to point out that, Frank Herbert, this classic sci-fi series that was written in the 60s, Dune, features people who live in the desert, and they recycle all their bodily fluids inside their suits because they have no water, and that's how they keep going.
Right.
So it's kind of cool that, you know, your author and taking his ideas further with the climate sci-fi is pretty neat.
Dave, thanks for bringing that up. Did you think about Dune at all, Paolo?
Well, yeah, the clear sacks are definitely the low rent version of still suits.
Yeah, you see any other similarities to maybe things like that, Stephanie? Some of the ideas that Paolo's grappling with, you see in some other novels that you teach or other things in popular culture right now?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think we could expand the term cli-fi or climate fiction and think about Anthropocene fictions more broadly. Let's think about the whole era in which we really see human beings profoundly affecting geology and atmospheric science, climate systems, etc. You could go all the way back to some of the great novels of the atomic age. I mean, I think about Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sleep? I mean, there's a lot of really interesting novels about nuclear apocalypse that actually do end up with ruined worlds that are not that different from what we're seeing in terms of predictions for catastrophic climate shift. And I think that some of the lessons to be learned from those fictions are still relevant today. And of course, that whole moment of great acceleration economically, socially, in terms of population explosion in the mid-20th century, which those earlier science fiction novels were responding to, are part of what caused the situation we're in now, with this very difficult ecological problem called global climate change. So, yeah, you can definitely go back and see all different kinds of responses from fiction writers who've perceived a ruined world, but also perceived, more importantly, how to live into and beyond that.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the great things about Paolo's work as well, that we're not just stopping with apocalypse per se.
Yeah, that actually something I'm less interested in apocalypses, and I feel like there's a lot of that happens in science fiction. And going back to Dune, one of the things that's interesting about watching the culture that functions on the planet of Dune is that it's all about a culture that has adapted fundamentally to the idea of water scarcity. It's people living within the boundaries and limits of what their ecology provides, and that's really interesting to me. And specifically, then writing climate fiction is the idea that here's this planet that we live on that has certain boundaries that we've sort of allowed ourselves to pretend don't exist, because of our technological know-how. We've managed to press those boundaries to a certain extent, and I think climate change is sort of that reality check moment where, well, yes, you can push the system to a certain extent, but it's a lot like stretching a rubber band. Eventually it's going to snap back at us. And I'm interested most in those stories that focus, when we talk about the Anthropocene or climate change fiction, I'm most interested in those stories where it talks about how are we fundamentally going to adapt and how does that shift everything, not in the sense of like, oh, we all get wiped out and then we start over with sort of the new frontier, but that we all will mostly be here and there will be some winners and some losers, but, it's not going to be some very clean break. I mean, the thing that troubles me the most, I think, with apocalyptic fiction is that it's so similar, that, the nuclear apocalypse looks a lot like the bioapocalypse, looks a lot like the zombie apocalypse.
It all ends up looking like the zombie apocalypse at the end of the day, which is a story we can tell over and over again.
And I don't, and it's not the one that's the most interesting to me, because it's so interesting to sort of like, when I was putting the water knife together, you know, there is this sense that like, oh, different players will have different amounts of power, and certain people certainly will lose, and certain people certainly will end up being wiped out, but other people are going to consolidate their power. It's, you know, for every person who's losing, there's somebody else's opportunity.
Hmm.
And so there's a larger set of, you know, complex interactions, and you sort of want to parse those. You know, you sort of want to look at, like, well, how does Las Vegas work? How does Phoenix work? How does California work? How does that work inside of the context of the larger United States? Are we a functioning nation that can work together and solve problems, or are we actually a set of states all going in our separate directions?
Yeah, it, not to give too much away about your book, but we don't seem to be a functioning United States in the water knife. We're going to get to a few people who have ideas about climate fiction. Alan's in Brooklyn. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? One movie that's not directly about carbon-caused climate change shows a world that is definitely affected by similar problems, and it's also the result of human folly and short-sightedness. That's a late 1950s British film called The Day the Earth Caught Fire, where mindless nuclear testing has caused the Earth to shift its balance on its axis and to change its orbit, so it's moving closer to the sun. So the reactions people have to the changes they brought about are very similar to the kinds of feigned surprise at what happens when you weren't paying attention to details that we get today when we are mindless about carbon emissions. So it's sort of a very useful object lesson, even though it's not directly caused by the same kind of folly.
Well, Alan, thank you very much for the idea. I do appreciate it. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Stephanie, is there a sense that we need stories about climate change if we're actually going to reckon with this problem? I mean, are the stories helpful in terms of a better future for us?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's really exciting, and it's even being performed on the show right now, is that climate fictions or Anthropocene fictions, they kind of summon a climate change public. Expertise is distributed very broadly. In a case like this, where you have readers who know a tremendous amount about the kinds of stories that have been told, the forms of adaptation down to the actual, you know, particular technologies that have been imagined, and there are very active fan fiction communities where people are talking about these things. So I think there's a very strong impetus toward materialized, detailed storytelling about how to get through the changes we are anticipating and how to be, frankly, better sociologically speaking or culturally speaking about planning, about working together, the very problems that, again, come up so much in Paulo's fiction. So it seems to me that one of the lessons I've learned from studying the sociological phenomenon of climate fiction is that people want stories as a way to become more ecologically effective and thriving beings. I mean, this seems to be a very big part of our sort of hardwiring and softwiring as humans, to create stories that complement the science, but that also give us futures to live into, to inhabit, in ways that are very hard for many young people to do, for instance. Of course, I'm a teacher, so I see a lot of that.
Well, and I have to ask you, Paulo, because you've written climate fiction for teens. How do you approach those stories differently?
Well, I think that there's something really interesting for me, at least when I'm writing for teens. Oftentimes, I'm actually trying to drop in some element of hope that I might not hand off automatically to my adult readers.
Very kind of you.
But it connects largely to a larger set of ideas about what fiction and science fiction can do or should do, which is that there are these different paths you can sort of occupy. And so one of those lines is the path of warning. So set out a signpost out in the future and say, this looks like a bloody future. Like, let's not go there. Just now that, you know, we're talking also about, you know, can you set out signposts that act as guideposts towards a positive future, that act as templates for us to live into, myths that we can believe in and aim towards. And I think that science fiction actually has a really interesting history of doing exactly that. You have this history of, you know, NASA engineers being able to talk about how they read about rocket ships and now they build rocket ships. People who've read things like Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon went out and built Second Life, a virtual reality game, because they read about an interesting object in the book and then wanted to create it. For me, when I was writing the story Shipbreaker for young adults, I wanted to create the idea that we could have a sustainable global future, one where we're still connected to the world, but we function according using sustainable energy. And so I looked again at sail and sail power. And we did have a functioning global economy and until coal took over based on sail. But, you know, what would it be like in the future if, you know, we took all of our technological know-how and we applied it to sail again and said, what kind of clipper ships would we build today? Would we have high-altitude air parasails? Would we have hydrofoils? Would we have, what would we do with material science? What would it, what would knowing so much about, you know, the physics of water, what do all those things allow us to do now with the same sort of, quote, basic, unquote, technologies that our forebears created a global economy with? What could we do now? And then to make that look fast and sleek and exciting, and that's something that's very much present in the in Shipbreaker, is the idea that here's something interesting about, here's a sustainable technology, here's a way we could live that maybe is better than the one we have right now. Let's go in that direction.
And Stephanie, we just have a few seconds left, but do you see more hope in some of these novels, the type that Paolo just outlined?
You know, I think hope is always negotiation and relationship. I think it has to be worked out in very specific contexts. And I like Paolo's suggestion that we always have to start locally. We have to embed ourselves in a particular situation and think about how we might work through, let's say, the future of Arizona, you know? Mm. And I think if you can get a little bit local, if you can make your scale small, then you can work out very particular technological and social kinds of relationship that actually might be describable as hope.
Well, and hope is what we're looking for right now. Stephanie Lemonager is the Moore Professor of English and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Paolo Bacigalupi is a sci-fi writer and the author of the novel The Water Knife, which is just out in paperback. Thank you both for joining me today on the show. You can read an excerpt from Paolo's book, The Water Knife, at our website at sciencefriday.com/waterknife. Earlier this week, we asked you about your favorite climate change stories. We've got a good reading list up at sciencefriday.com/climate stories. Check it out. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim and Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Ira's back next week in New York. I'm John Dankosky.